Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. The U.S. Open Tennis Championships are underway, and during these exciting 2 weeks at the biggest sporting event in the country, I always like to bring you unique stories and insight. So this morning, I thought I would introduce you to Andy Taylor, who has been the voice of Arthur Ashe Stadium Court at the U.S. Open for the past 22 years. If you've had the opportunity to watch tennis in Arthur Ashe Stadium, the show court of all courts at the U.S. Open, then you have indeed heard Andy Taylor's voice doing his thing. And I also visit with Madeline Blaze, or Maddie as she likes to be called, who wrote Queen of the Court, The Many Lives of Tennis Legend Alice Marble. Alice Marble won 5 Grand Slam titles, singles titles, many other doubles Grand Slam titles in the late 30s, and dazzled the tennis world with her style, personality, and larger-than-life persona. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and my guest is Andy Taylor, who's making me laugh. Andy is the voice of Arthur Ashe Stadium. PA announcer wasn't glamorous enough, yeah. But welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And it's always good to see you in the halls here in Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Well, this is your 22nd year. Is that correct?
Something along those lines. It all started in 2002 with Venus and Serena in the championship match. And the next night you had Pete Sampras winning his 14th and final major against Andre Agassi. And clearly, after you have a moment like that, why would you not keep coming back year after year?
Well, you have a few more years to catch up to me. However, we won't go there. So, talk about
you don't
them.
Look that old, Ann. You don't look like a day over 29.
Well, I started when I was 10. Come on. They let juniors here.
It all starts to make sense.
And your beard is getting longer and a little more gray, but we won't go there.
As you get younger, I continue to get older. And you should see my back. We won't get into that.
No, don't. I don't want to see your back at this point. But anyway, so we are up in our broadcast booth, and I am literally 2 doors down from where you've been for 22 years. When did we come up here?
Oh, I've been here in Arthur Ashe Stadium because it opened in, 97?
Okay, you're right.
The year Venus won her first U.S. Open title. And so, yeah, we've been up here for well over 20 years at this point.
When you get to over 40, you forget a lot. And honestly, numbers always kind of never really mattered to me. But anyway, that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. So, Andy, talk about that first year. Talk about the matches you saw and, Serena, beat her sister, right, in the final. And then Sampras beat, was it Agassi?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Here's the deal. So, I played tennis in high school, and Tri-Valley League doubles champion with my buddy Christian Blomqvist. We were amazing, but then I started working. I had a regular life.
What high school?
This was up in Westwood, Massachusetts, okay? But I started working, and I had a regular life, and I was traveling the country doing radio. I had settled in Missouri well before 2002. It was around 1997. And so I hadn't watched tennis in forever. I knew Andre Agassi, but only from, Canon Rebel commercials for cameras. I didn't know what Grand Slams were played on grass, hard court, or dirt, or what. I didn't know. And so I was doing this event for the USTA in Springfield. It was a Fed Cup event. Billie Jean King was the captain of the Fed Cup team. Lindsay Davenport was in town. Chanda Rubin was playing for the squad. Monica Seles was on the team too, and they were playing Israel. And so I went, not knowing what to expect, as a favor to a friend, to MC and announce essentially this Fed Cup tie between the U.S. and Israel. And at the end of the second day, I got a tap on my shoulder, And this gentleman in a ball cap and a button-down shirt said, Andy, what would you think about doing this, doing something like this at the U.S. Open in New York? Well, here I am, a morning radio show host in the middle of the Midwest in Missouri. These opportunities never come along like that. So I just blew the guy off. I said something like, yeah, whatever, pal, and left. And 2 weeks later, I was at work and I had finished my show and somebody said, hey, you got a call from New York. The USTA would like to talk to you. Oh, and by the way, they wanted to mention that the next time the president of the USTA asks you a question, you please don't blow him off. And so that's when it all started. And I came up here to New York just to do the night sessions. And it was a humbling honor to get the opportunity to work with Tom Morera, who was the U.S. Open voice for many years. And it was such a different sort of way of performing at the U.S. Open. Tom was the Bob Shepard-esque, silky smooth, smooth as glass, incredible voice, very calming, but had impact in his delivery. During that time, in the early 2000s, everything was kind of changing and evolving. We were having more stars open the show on opening night and doing bigger and louder productions. And so they wanted a voice that would kind of match that. So they had Tom do the day sessions here in Arthur Ashe Stadium. And then they had this brash storytelling kid from Springfield, Missouri, come in and do the night sessions. And so that's what I did. And it just turned into me as the voice of Arthur Ashe Stadium for over 20 years, and I'm the luckiest dude in the world to have had the opportunity to do that.
I love that. So how have you changed since you've been here, your approach to announcing, not you personally, but how has your announcing here in Arthur Ashe Stadium changed through the years, do you think?
Well, you know, there was that obvious difference in the first year between this smooth professional like Tom and then this loud, obnoxious kid that was trying to tell the stories of these incredible athletes during the night session. And I would say in the first, I don't know, between 2002 and 2012, I would even get out of the booth and like do giveaways in the stands with camera operators and really work the crowd and have a lot of fun. We have so many video walls and technology at our disposal in this stadium now that you don't need a dancing monkey like that, which is essentially what I've become. And so when we didn't need that anymore and we could depend on tech to keep the crowd entertained or allow the audience to entertain itself, which they are so good at here in New York,
And they love watching themselves, obviously.
Oh, yeah. It gives me a chance to focus now more on the players and their stories and to accentuate moments that happen during ceremonies or what's happening on court after a match. And I would say I probably toned it down quite a bit, but I probably didn't have much of a choice because I'm an old man now and these things happen.
I love that. I'm going to have you do some voice impressions in a second because, as you say, you are a voiceover artist extraordinaire. That's what you do when you're not covering this tennis. So do you do tennis announcing in other parts of the world as well?
Yes. So this job in Arthur Ashe Stadium led to other opportunities in the U.S. For one season, I did the Memphis Open when that was still around. I worked at Indian Wells for a couple of years and got to witness Larry Ellison put up a brand new stadium too in less than 11 months. That was incredible. To have a tennis court, and that was like my home, was Stadium 2 at Indian Wells. And after being in Arthur Ashe Stadium and then being in a smaller stadium like that, it's heaven. You know, because you get to see the action up close and the fans get to be, genuinely part of the experience day in and day out.
Plus, being in the desert in March isn't bad.
And having Nobu and who knows what else is up there now, these incredible restaurants overlooking the court. And, you know, you'd look up and you'd be like, oh, there's Ivo Karlovic having some sushi right now watching this match. That's incredible. But so I did that for 4 or 5 years. And then I started working with this team in Qatar. And so I do a lot of different events for the Qatar Tennis Federation, the Qatar Squash Federation, and that group. So if there's a men's or a women's tennis event over there, You'll hear my voice. You'll see me on court doing the post-match interviews, wearing a suit, trying to look not fat.
And 100-degree temperatures, probably.
No. We usually do it in February or March, so it's not too bad. And then if it's a squash event, that's usually indoors, so you're okay. And they try to keep that as cold as possible. But I also did a paddle event for the first time this past year, which is an absolutely fascinating sport to watch. I know pickleball is huge right now, but like if you ever have the opportunity to go experience professional paddle up close and personal, that's some eye candy worth watching.
Well, I'm sure the pickleball people will be after you sooner.
No, I'm happy for them too. Go keep dinking and dunking and doing your thing. But as far as something to watch, man, those glass-walled sports are really, it's a fun thing to see.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So quick. And you know, the athletes are extraordinary. So come back here to Arthur Ashe Stadium. Here we are. Opening day. What has been, you've seen so many, you've announced so many. What is your highlight, your own personal highlight? Which match of all the matches that, you know, I saw Andre Agassi grow up on these courts. Remember, he was had long hair and had the denim shorts. I am dating myself. I used to call him the denim dynamo. Saw Serena and Venus all those years. Roger Federer win 5 U.S. Open titles.
Right.
And this year Djokovic is going for a 24th Grand Slam title to tie Margaret Court. I mean, you've seen so much right here in the mecca of the U.S. Open. Can you pinpoint one favorite match?
No. I mean, long story short, no, I can't. Because, you know, for me, as far as favorite moments, being a part of this team and working in this stadium is seeing how special it is to somebody who experiences this for the first time. Seeing a young fan who's part of, you know, a junior tennis league get the opportunity to come out on court here in Arthur Ashe Stadium, the sport's biggest stage, and warm things up for the audience before, you know, Novak Djokovic or Rafa Nadal comes out on court. Those are the moments.
Say that again, Rafa.
Rafa Nadal. Rafael Nadal. But those are the moments that are most special to me and the things that I, you know, unconsciously latch on to. So, yes, you know, Roger Federer's won 5 majors here, and we've seen all these incredible accomplishments and Carlos Alcaraz and what he was able to do last year. But for me, as somebody who's working this event, it's about New York. It's about the people who work this tournament. It's about the fans who come back year after year for that experience. It's seeing them on these big screens during a night session where you have an incredible match, but they've got other things on their mind and they're entertaining themselves. And it's just a different vibe, a crazy atmosphere. And those are the moments that mean the most to me and that I remember more than anything else.
Of course. I mean, New York. And the latest match that you worked would be what?
Last year, Jannik Sinner, Carlos Alcaraz. I think that was the match, right?
And what time did you leave?
We did not leave. Was it the match ended at 2:47? Is that right? And so we didn't get out of here until 3:30 in the morning.
Wow. Yeah. You had to be at your best at 2:47 in the morning.
We've had more, you know, there was a Kei Nishikori Andy Murray match, maybe. I know Kei Nishikori was part of it, and that one ended at like 2:27, and it tied a previous record match. You know who was the worst at this? Todd Martin.
Yes.
Todd Martin was always like, you know what? I know I'm the second match on Ash during the night session, but I'm going to drop the first two sets. And then third, I'm going to win in a tie break. The fourth is going to be brutal. I'm going to win that. And then at, you know, 1:47, we're going to start the decider. And every time we saw Todd, we were like, oh, great.
Here. And he didn't start until the women's match before him went to the third set, you know.
Yeah.
In a tiebreaker.
And if it wasn't Todd, it was Rozenski. He was classic. When he would play on center court here in Arthur Ashe Stadium, it was like, okay, we're going to be late tonight.
So what is the most bizarre thing you've seen from your announcing booth? Because as you say, the fans get into it. They have a little, you know, they're overserved, let's say, just put it that way. And they're having fun. They love the party atmosphere, especially at night.
Full-on fist fights. I've seen that at least 6 times. And then one of the more entertaining ones, and I don't know if the video is still available on YouTube, but it was for years. There was a gentleman getting down in one of the VOMs, the areas where you can exit Arthur Ashe Stadium, and there were some steps behind him. And you can imagine he's probably 60, 65 years old, maybe a little bit older, probably had a few pops with his buddies while he was here, and he was just trying to get on the big screen, trying to get on the camera with his dance moves, and he just bailed over backwards and rolled down the stairs. And he's okay, from what I understand. Everything's fine. But, it's one of those Instagram videos that I'm sure would get millions and billions of views and reviews if, I'm not an Insta guy.
So this year, the U.S. Open is celebrating the 50th anniversary of equal prize money. I can't believe it's been 50 years. Thank you very much, Billie Jean King and all the people at the USTA that made it happen. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's amazing. The fact that we're celebrating it, that we've been doing it for 50 years, number one. But what I really think about it is there's a very special moment that's going to happen tonight as well that many of you may not notice, and I think you should. While we've been paying men and women equally here at the U.S. Open for 50 years, one thing that has never happened is we've never had a female lead voice here in Arthur Ashe Stadium. It's been Tom Herrera, it's been Andy Taylor, the voice of the U.S. Open. Well, guess what? We're finally shattering that glass ceiling this year. Blair Henley, who is just an amazing talent and committed to telling the stories of these characters in tennis and is a rock star at everything she does, has handled the day session here in Arthur Ashe Stadium. And tonight, with all of the ceremony, the pomp and circumstance, the introduction of Billie Jean King, we will have a female voice in Arthur Ashe Stadium to do the entire ceremony and the rest of the matches. And I think it's phenomenal. And it's not just a one-off. Blair's going to be doing many, many, many of the sessions here at the 2023 U.S. Open. And honestly, it's an honor to take a back seat to that because I think it's important. It's finally happening that we're shattering that glass ceiling here.
Well said, Andy. And I'm sure she appreciates your support as well. So you'll be doing half and she'll be doing half, basically? Is that how it's going to work this year?
Yeah, so I'll do, like, on day two, round one continues. I'll do the day and night session. Blair deserves some time off because she's been busting her butt all last week as part of Fan Week as well. And then she'll do the day session on Wednesday, and I'll do the night session. The next day, I'll work both day and night. And we're kind of rotating on and off like that. And I think it's great.
So when you're not here, you say you own a voice artist business. You have your own studio in your home. So what can you give me some examples of this work of yours that we may not hear here at Arthur Ashe Stadium? Yeah. I want to hear some of your voices. What are some of your favorite voices?
Well, it's not like, I mean, voice acting has very, many different levels. And it's not like I do game shows or things like that. There's, for example, if you ever want to learn more about finance, if you Google John's Money Adventures, you might hear me describing ETFs and various different financial tools that you could use to work on your retirement account. And a lot of my voiceover is for other sports. Before there was this military takeover in Myanmar, there's a sport there called Letwe. And Letwe is the art of nine limbs. And it's a very brutal martial art that goes back, generations. And so you can use your knees, you can use your elbows. You can only add a little tape to your hands while you're fighting. A lot of headbutts go on. It's a bloody thing. So I was hired to be their their MC, their announcer, but they didn't want me to fly in. They didn't want to fly me in for it. So I would get in my voiceover booth, and I'm just going to back off a little bit for this. And this is essentially the... Everybody else? Hey, how are you? Nobody's getting on the radio right now?
We should have video.
Welcome to the ancient art of Letway! And so I would basically do this entire event as this ridiculous, insane character. Unfortunately, they don't have those events anymore.
And where did that character come from?
They said, we want a crazy person to introduce, you know, these fighters because of what fans are about to see. And they said, go nuts, you know, hopefully what you do will work out. And so I just went in the booth and went crazy, and they went, yeah, that's it.
Oh, my God, what a great story. Really, really great. Okay, before I let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot. Who are you picking to win this U.S. Open in the men's and women's?
Jannik Sinner for the guys. He's, you know, it's
because you like his name.
I think it's, you know, his match here last year and what he's been able to accomplish. I think he's got a real opportunity here. I would love to see Tommy Paul do well as well. And on the ladies' side.
Well, before we get to the ladies, so not Alcaraz, not Djokovic. You're not going for the 1 and 2 seeds. And Djokovic going for his 24th Grand Slam to tie Margaret Court's record. That doesn't excite you.
Why would I make the easy pick, Anne? You gotta give him a little dirt, give him a little substance out there. And
Jannik Sinner. Give me a Jannik Sinner.
Jannik Sinner.
And what about the ladies?
Well, I would have said Maria Sakkari, but unfortunately
somebody did pick Maria Sakkari here. I swear, not me, but one of our colleagues. We will not mention his name.
I think it would be amazing to see Jessica or Coco actually pull it off this year, you know, and it would be neat to see them pick up the doubles title as well. I mean, Coco's done this at Roland Garros. Was it 2 years ago or was it last year? But I mean, she was a singles finalist at Roland Garros, and she and Jessie were doubles finalists.
She came into this having won 2 hard court titles, so she's playing really great tennis right now.
So like Jessie won the Canadian Open, right, in Montreal, and Coco just won Cincinnati. Both of them beat world number one Iga Swiatek in the semifinals to reach those championship matches. So, yeah, as far as rhythm is concerned, they're both in it to win it.
What's your favorite name to pronounce of all the years you've been working? And I want to hear you pronounce it.
I think the one that's most recognizable that people always ask me to say is, of course, you know, please welcome the number one player in the world, Rafael Nadal. And I'm toning it down quite a bit. But people also like Novak Djokovic. But as far as like, I don't have a favorite name in tennis that I've had to.
How about with the ladies?
What are some interesting ones that I've done?
Well, you announced Serena Williams enough, right? Are you going to miss her this year?
Who isn't going to miss Serena Williams? I mean, God, what an amazing career. What an amazing talent. Congratulations on her second kid.
Child.
This is incredible. But, yeah, I will always miss seeing and saying 23-time Grand Slam champion Serena Williams. I will always miss that.
Annie Taylor, thanks so much. How much fun. Really a joy to catch up with you, and continued success.
Always fun to see you, and we'll high-five each other wandering the halls here in Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Thanks so much. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Maddie Blaze, author of Queen of the Court, The Many Lives of Tennis Legend Alice Marble. Maddie, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. I'm thrilled to be on your show and thrilled to be talking about my new book.
Well, Alice Marble, just a legend, an American tennis player who won 18 Grand Slam championships between 1936 and 1940. She won 5 singles Grand Slam titles, four at the U.S. Open, one at Wimbledon, six women's doubles Grand Slam titles, seven mixed doubles Grand Slam titles. She was ranked number one in the game in 1939. Yet, Maddie, if we were to ask many of the spectators at the U.S. Open Championship going on right now, they probably would not even know her name. How come?
That, first of all, that's a wonderful question. It's a question I struggled with over the course of the 7 years that I spent trying to write her biography. I would tell people I was working on a book about Alice Marble, and the inevitable question was, Alice who? And so I would explain, first of all, her glittering sports credentials, but I also tried to situate her in time and place. She was the it girl of tennis, and maybe even the it girl of the world, in the late 1930s, when her career really took off as a tennis player. She was known throughout the beginning of the 1930s as a much younger tennis player who had her ups and downs, and she was followed. But really, the last two or three years of the 1930s, she was as famous as Seabiscuit, the horse, and followed with as much passion by the public as they did Seabiscuit. She was what we would call today an influencer. Not only was she obviously very talented at her sport, tennis, she designed clothes. She was the subject of a great deal of publicity. She was a torch singer at one point in the fall and winter of 38, 39, before she went to Wimbledon that July, and that's when she did her clean sweep of Wimbledon. Her career came to, if not a skidding halt, something resembling that, because 6 or 7 weeks after she won Wimbledon, Hitler invaded Poland. And of course, all of Europe was immediately set into a tailspin that we now know, of course, as World War II, which at one point, Alice Marble, who became also, after her career ended as an athlete and a writer for American Lawn Tennis and have a couple of memoirs, but she always called World War II an inconvenient international event, which derailed her career. So here she was on top of the world, would have gone on and won more titles almost inevitably. I don't think anyone would argue that she wouldn't have. There was no tennis. Yes, there was tennis in 1940. There was the national championships, what we call today the U.S. Open, and she did a clean sweep there. But by then, international tennis was gone, and even the number of players who came in 1940 to Forest Hills, it was scant. People couldn't come from Europe, obviously, so it wasn't the same kind of roster, that the depth of roster that she was used to. She still maintained her dignity as the most titled tennis player at that moment in time, female tennis player, but realized she needed to be not just the queen of the courts, but the queen of the pivot, which she was her entire life. And she threw herself into the war effort in her own way, which mainly consisted of dozens and dozens, hundreds really, of exhibition matches with the troops and with a colleague named Mary Hardwick, who was another tennis player with whom she'd played doubles frequently and also played against her in singles during a professional tour. But she went to various bases, and the most delicious moment of all those visits to all those bases all over the country was, there was a young man in Norfolk, Virginia, who was in the service, who saw her play. And afterwards, a kind of an exacting young man, someone with high standards, had a little baby girl at home that he couldn't be with as he served our country, watched Alice Marble play and said, "Now that's a great athlete." Many years pass. His little girl, Billie Jean Moffett, wants to be a tennis player. Alice Marble's career is in decline. She's living in Southern California. Her fame is diminishing. Not precipitously, she's always sort of in the limelight, but she's giving tennis lessons. She's not in good health, not in good shape, not making the best decisions, up to and including smoking on the court while teaching tennis.
Wow.
Heard of by today's standards. But Billie Jean, a young teen, gets sent to train with her on the weekends for over the course of several months. around 1959, 1960. And in the fullness of time, Billie Jean King credits Alice Marble with really instilling in her the aggressive sense of play that characterized Billie Jean King, and that many people say was pioneered by Alice Marble.
Wow. Well, let's go back. I mean, obviously, there's so much. You did so much research to, you know, get to know this woman back, who just was this just a shining star in the 30s. And of course, you know, she's a fascinating subject. But how long did it take you to put this book together and to draw all kinds of this information about Alice Marble? Because she was also kind of mysterious in some ways as well.
You know, it certainly took longer than I thought it would. And some of the research was interrupted by a different international inconvenient event, the pandemic. So there are certain trips I had to postpone, unfortunately. A lot of the research I'd done before the pandemic, but that slowed things down and slowed down the publishing industry. So everything kind of got held in abeyance for a bit. But basically, there were a couple of things I didn't realize as I set forth on this project. One is later did I realize how brazen a genre biography is. If you're writing about someone who's long gone or somewhat long gone, as in the case of Alice Marble, who died in 1990 at the age of 77, so most of her peers were gone, not that many, very few people really remember her at this point, who are still remember her when she was alive, obviously. And the job of the biographer is nothing short of resurrection, of, you know, bringing this person back to life. So I got really humbled by that early on and thought, what have I gotten myself into? This is a big deal. This isn't just a...
You had a huge life.
It's such complex. A panoramic life that got touched by, you know, she was famous. She had famous movie stars as friends. She had influences, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, in the terms of, she's largely considered the person who spearheaded the beginning of integration in tennis and gets credit for that. Just all kinds of things that she did. But this was the part that was really a challenge. And it is that even though she led this grand life with wonderful accomplishments that are extremely easily demonstrated and proven, she led kind of a shadow life in her mind, especially as time went on, where she believed certain fantasies about things that had happened in her life that likely did not. I'd love to be proven wrong, but at the moment, I don't believe she was married to a wonderful war hero secretly, who after he died on a mission in Germany, left her in such a state of grief that she somehow turned to the US government, who immediately recruited her as a spy in Switzerland, where she kind of saved the world from the Nazis. I just don't quite believe that happened because there's no data to support it. But she led this life where, as time went on, some of the things that she said about herself were likely not true.
Plus, she had written a couple autobiographies, right? I had read in her second autobiography, Courting Danger, which apparently she wrote in 1945. She agreed to spy for U.S. intelligence obtaining Nazi financial data. And then she was shot in the back by a Nazi agent. I mean, apparently this was in her second autobiography.
And she said that that's the book that she wrote with Dale Leatherman, her collaborator, who's actually a sports journalist in her own right. And Dale Leatherman has talked to me about the book and how it is and is told to book. And it was written in 1990 or the late 1980s, before Google, before really the internet. And Leatherman was taking down what Alice Marble said. It didn't really question it. She understood this to be a memoir she was collaborating on, not researching on her own. But at one point, Leatherman said one of the things, this is early on in my interviewing, that stuck with me and helped me as I tried to capture the complexities of Alice Marble, which is, even as she was proven to be somewhat flawed, you know, lonely, filled with kind of fantasies, this and that, apparently, even at the end, she would sometimes reconstitute herself in a way that was amazing. And she would seem it, you know, if you just saw her like in a house dress with a cigarette looking frail, you'd think this woman shouldn't even leave the house. It'd be too much effort. She would somehow get herself into a really nice, crisp, nice looking outfit and get up at a luncheon in Palm Desert where she spent her final years. By that, I mean the last 25 years of her life or so. But she'd get up and she'd give a talk and she'd rivet the audience. And Dale Leatherman described her as being like an old racehorse heeding the call of a bugle. And that phrase absolutely permeated my research. Because I kept thinking, okay, there's ups, there's downs. You know, she had possibly had tuberculosis when she was young. Even as a child, she had deficits. Her father died when she was six. Her mother was left with five children. It was catch as catch can, a lot of financial stress. She was kind of the family hero, but once she became a public figure in the world of tennis, she barely even got to see her family as the years went on. It was a different era. People weren't able to fly in and out of places as readily, obviously. But she still maintained this dignity and this drive that never left her.
And think of the status of women back in the 30s, 20s, 30s, and 40s. They really, aside from maybe as a profession, teacher or nurse, what else did women do back then, right? I mean, she overcame... As an athlete, she did things that most women never dreamed about doing or even possible. You know, that they didn't even dream that these things were even possible to do, I would imagine.
Absolutely correct. And I'm really glad you brought that point up because I was aware, even though Alice Merble lived in the center of history at certain points in her life, you know, met FDR, socialized with Ronald Reagan, that kind of thing. She was still a woman, which meant she lived in the shadows of history, or what I call the outskirts, using the word quite as literally as a pun. Not really in the center of things, as was the case of most women in the 20th century. Very few got to be the center, I don't know of anyone actually, the center of everything all the time. Maybe there's a few men like that too. But at any rate, she really needed to, at times her resources were limited, basically because she was a woman. When I do the little passage about how she was a torch singer at the Waldorf Astoria, I have some information I got from the New York Times that I researched about what opportunities there were for women, and according to the classified ads, which were segregated by gender in the Times. And a woman could maybe be a switchboard operator, you know, for I forget what it was, like $25 a week or something. Those were the opportunities. So she was not, she was really in a whole different stratosphere than the few working women that were out there getting an income. Most women were not working.
Absolutely. I mean, she lived this larger than life persona at a time when, I guess if you were a famous actress, perhaps you'd, have that same kind of, fame. But just fascinating that she was able to do all of this, really not from a wealthy family either, right? She was always kind of struggling financially.
Two keywords there. I want to talk about Carol Lombard, but first I'll answer the question about the family's finances. When her father died, the family did have a mortgage on a house in San Francisco in the Sunset District, but there was no income to continue paying the mortgage. So her older brother was 13. He dropped out of school and spent the years of his teenage years basically laying floors in properties throughout San Francisco. When her younger brother, a couple of years later, got to be 13, he also dropped out of school to follow this into the same pursuit so they could have some cash flow in the house. The mom got a job cleaning offices and would wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and go into different offices in San Francisco and clean them. There was a sister a couple years older who unfortunately managed when she was 16, and it's a little, not a lot of details are given, but it sounds like it was a very bad scene. She managed to run away with a bad choice of a guy become pregnant. Maybe she was pregnant before she ran away. It's a little unclear, but within months was back at the house with a new baby. So she wasn't working. And those are the three older siblings. Alice was the first one in her family to graduate from high school. She did not go on to college. She also, the family were all workers. One of Alice Merble's grandnieces, who I spoke to, a woman named Linda McCrory, talked about how they were always workers, that family. And Alice Merble was always a worker. I mean, at the end of her life, when her income was pretty nebulous, she worked as a pool attendant at her condo complex. She taught tennis. Sometimes she taught lessons for free because she felt that the kids couldn't pay and she wanted them to have lessons. She also had a bartending license so she could get cash that way.
Wow. And where did the DuPont patronage come in? Was it Will DuPont? How did that work out?
Will DuPont was in the 1930s, the most famous banker in the world. And he lived in Delaware and he lived in a beautiful estate. It's all kind of, in some senses, it sounds like it's out of some kind of fairy tale. He had, he loved horses and tennis. Those were his two passions. And in the early, late 30s, early 40s, he fell in love, it seems, from afar and then from close up with Alice Merble. There's a line in the book that he's her knight in shining armor. The problem is he smelled of mud and manure and it didn't matter to him. He was just known, he was kind of known for being a little bit unkempt looking, smelling like the farm, but utterly in love with Alice Merble. And she just didn't have it in her to run away with him, and didn't think that there any union between them would work out. He did help manage her money, and he did create an annuity for her, which especially as she aged up, she referred to airily as an annuity created by an old suitor, you know, whose name she wouldn't give, even though he was dead, but she didn't want anybody bothering him, even posthumously. But it wasn't a ton of money, because I saw the will. It was nothing that would keep you in the kind of a lifestyle that she got accustomed to when she was a professional tennis, an amateur tennis player on the circuit and living at various mansions, in, especially on Long Island, at the behest of very rich people and with giving her the use of their courts. She spent time at William Randolph Hearst Castle. In exchange for being there as a teen, she would play tennis with Charlie Chaplin and people like that. That was kind of her hostess gift, or her host gift. So she had she'd been in glittering circles, but she did not have that kind of.
Right. I know. You know, it's such an incredible entree to this world that, you know, you're not accustomed to. It's just fascinating. Well, I think one of the most important things that Alice Merble did, Maddie, she wrote an editorial in support of Althea Gibson in a 1950 issue of American Lawn Tennis Magazine. And it really was a strong statement in support of Althea. And eventually Althea was granted entry to play in the 1950 U.S. Open Championships. And she became the first African-American player to compete in a Grand Slam event. And perhaps that not would have happened if it weren't for the legendary Alice Merble.
Well, Alice Merble would say, and she kind of did in this editorial that she wrote for American Lawn Tennis, that it was inevitable that people like Althea Gibson would be invited into tennis. It's the arc of the world, she believed, went in that direction. But that why not sooner rather than later? And that piece of writing of Alice Merble's, the publisher or the editor, George Gibson, insisted it be reproduced word for word in the back of my book. So anybody who wants to read it can find it there quite readily. And I'm the type of person who would love to see all school children in America memorize it because it's beautifully written and it really is the most eloquent statement on fair play that I've ever, ever, ever read in my life. And she embarrassed the tennis establishment into acting fairly quickly to allow Gibson to play. But even in 1950, as they also didn't give entirely with full and open hearts, because they made a rule that the man and the woman who were the champions in the Black Tennis League, the American Tennis League, the reigning man and woman could automatically play in at Forest Hills in the national championships. They didn't have to go to any of the qualifying tournaments. Now, that is not helpful to them, because the qualifying tournaments are where you get to gauge everybody, you get to make friends, you get to see who you don't like. You learn a lot by being at the various tournaments that lead up to the big competition. And by denying them access to those tournaments, they handicapped them in some ways, and of course didn't recognize it publicly. So, but it started the motion that we can all applaud.
Absolutely. I was at the unveiling of the Althea Gibson statue at the U.S. Open at the National Tennis Center, the Billie Jean King USTA National Tennis Center. And as you mentioned earlier, Alice Marble taught tennis in Palm Desert, California, and one of her students was none other than Billie Jean King. Do you think Marble was a huge influence on Billie Jean off the court as well?
You know, I talked to Billie Jean. We had one interview. She was wonderful. She was very thoughtful, very reflective. She said a couple of things about how she admired Alice Marble almost more than any other female tennis player that came before her, because of her strong stand supporting other women and just not letting go of that. So not just supporting Black players, but, you know, people of color who were playing, but also women. And she just felt that Alice Marble just stood by her guns over and over in her life.
I definitely agree. Maddie, this year's championship, the U.S. Open, celebrates the 50th anniversary of becoming the first of tennis's four majors to offer equal prize money to men and women competitors, which is outstanding. I mean, 50 years, that's unbelievable that it's, you know, that it's been that long that there's been equal prize money for men and women competitors at the U.S. Open, because it doesn't happen hardly. It took forever to make it happen at other majors as well. But what was it like, you know, getting back to Alice Marble's time playing tennis? You know, could she make any kind of income from tennis back then?
Well, that was part of the problem. As you know, I'm sure that the professionals didn't make an income. There was money under the table all the time that no one talked about. But a lot of the players came from wealth. And they wouldn't have become tennis players in many cases if they hadn't come from the kind of circumstance that encouraged them to be part of a club or even have a tennis court in their own backyard, as Sarah Palfrey Cook did, as did others. For Alice Marble, she became a tennis player because the city of San Francisco had a wonderful man who believed that all children should be close to, within walking distance of a park, and also, if possible, have more than just a piece of greenery, but maybe something to do. And thus she got to play on the free public courts in San Francisco. So her start was completely on kind of, really, she writes about how the courts were endearing because they were so flawed and so no matter, it was hard to keep them in good repair, but she still learned how to play on them.
And did she have support financially growing up playing these tournaments and traveling?
No, what she did was not really. I mean, what she had was a coach named Eleanor Teach Tennant, who's quite a character in the book, about 15 years older than Alice Marble, who was herself was at one point ranked number three in the United States as a tennis player, who kind of took Alice on lock, stock, and barrel. And their agreement was that whatever Alice Marble earned, they would share 50%. So as time went on, anything that if Alice wrote something, or even when she was singing at the Waldorf Astoria, all that money was shared 50-50. Until the relationship ended towards the end of the war. It ended inevitably. It was a famous tennis commentator named Ted Tingling said.
I remember Ted Tingling, the fashion designer, very well. I remember him. He was fabulous.
He was great. He was the one who, he got in trouble though, I think, for Gussie Moran's frilly
outfit. Panties.
Panties. But Ted Tingling said that once Alice won Wimbledon in 1939, it was going to be, the balance of power was going to change, and it did. And Alice finally got out of that relationship. It was a true, let me say this, Billie Jean King at one point said, you know, I'm not sure Coach Tennant did Alice Marble any favors. It was an old style of coaching in which the coach kind of owns the player. And that doesn't create for the player the kind of mental autonomy that they need. Later, Teach Tennant spent all the rest of many years trying to replicate this triumph. And she did work with Mo Connolly, but Mo Connolly, as a young teen, basically fired her.
Wow.
Thought she was way too negative and didn't like her, didn't like working with her.
But did she have the influence coaching the aggressive serve and volley style? Because as you mentioned, Alice Marble brought that to a game when most of the women played a baseline rally kind of style, and coming up and serving, you know, serve a net like Billie Jean did and Martina Navratilova, that was a more aggressive style of play that was very effective. Did her coach have that influence?
Because when Alice Marble first was playing tennis, she, as a teen, she was completely scattershot, almost crazily so. So she'd hit one great shot and then something terrible. You know, she was all over the court, and she was both effective at times, but at other times a hot mess. And that's who arrived to be tutored by Teach. The way that Alice Marble got into tennis was that she loved baseball, and she had an incredible arm. And she always believed that the best, you know, pitchers, if you know how to pitch, you know how to serve, she always felt. But she really wanted, baseball was her first love completely. She was a kid. She'd watch the San Francisco Seals play and be in the peanut gallery, and she'd catch the balls. And she was, even at the age of 12, called out on the field to help catch balls during a practice. And there was an article about her in the newspaper. So anyway, she came to the sport though with this, she was aggressive physically. She was not a timid kid. She was just extremely full power ahead. And she brought that style to tennis, but it had to be completely harnessed. And Teach worked with her, and then Teach had a fellow whose last name was Beese, B-E-E-S-E, work with, who wrote 10 books on tennis, work with Alice. And she just kept getting her tutored by different people that would take that energy and tame it, because it wasn't working untamed. Trust me.
Just a fascinating personality, Maddie Blaise. It's just, you did such a great job with the research of this book and bringing this incredible hero, really, back in the 30s, this woman, Alice Marble, to life. What's your next project? Or are you exhausted from this one?
Well, right now I'm doing some publicity, you know, some public appearances and things like that. And I don't know, you know, I'm going to say that I think I might want to write about Miami, because I lived there many years ago, and it always calls to me, Florida and Miami. I know you went to school in Florida, so there might be something about that up my sleeve.
All right. I know you won a Pulitzer Prize. So what an incredible career you've had. You've been a professor of journalism and sport at UMass, and well, continued success. I know you've written a number of books, and Queen of the Court, The Many Lives of Tennis Legend Alice Marble is a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. Maddie Blaise, thank you so much for joining us here on Sports Interview.
Thank you. I really appreciate this very much. Thank you.
My thanks to Andy Taylor, to Maddie Blaise, and to Mike Goodzone Production. Women should never apologize for being powerful, so remember that. Be safe, be kind, and I look forward to talking with you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGore.